You cannot get to the best place by justifying a better place than what the worst one was. It better easily becomes a distraction and the enemy of best.
Welcome to Business Second Opinion. Today, we're examining some of the ideas proffered about process improvement. In other words, getting better at doing things, how I grow me, my business, education, organizations. But is there anything really new, or are they just rearranging the deck chairs? But first, guess what I'm drinking? A Rebel Tasty Elixir. Maca cold brew, actually. Maca is the premier Andean superherb used in high-altitude central Peruvian plateaus. A favorite of elite athletes and anyone motivated to push their bodies to the limit of their potential. Rebel is not only a sponsor of our podcast here at Business Second Opinion, but they create righteous plant alchemy like this, which means it's good for your body, your being, and Mother Earth. And they go a step further to co-create a future without human trafficking. Rebel donates 2.5% of all net sales to Not For Sale. And through impact sourcing, they help communities to thrive and prevent their vulnerability to trafficking in the first place. Their rallying cry is, "We are Rebel."
We're so proud to be associated with them and to help them tell their story. So please go enjoy their great products. And if you want to find out where their locations are, check out their website at Rebel, REBBL.co.
Business Second Opinion is the podcast that digs deep to explore questions about business and business practice. These questions are ones you may not know you need to be asking, but we believe you should be asking. And in the process of examining them, we give you a second opinion, usually a contrarian opinion, but one that's well-tested and proven to give the outcomes you want without the nasty side effects. I'm Zach Swarta. And always with me is Carol Sanford, our in-house positive contrarian, responding to big and hard questions with a radically different take. How's it going, Carol?
Great. Hi, Zach.
So as our regular listeners know by now, we invite people to send questions or subjects they're wrestling with, and we try to build an episode around it. And as a thanks, we've actually started sending out one of our new Get a Second Opinion ceramic mugs for coffee or hot drinks or cold drinks or whatever you want. We've gotten several ideas through this process, and we decided to build this episode off of one of them in particular that we thought might be interesting for the rest of you. The subject was, what about Agile and Scrum as productivity or project management tools? In full disclosure, I'm actually a certified Scrum Master and have used many of these productivity programs over the years. But conversations like these can easily turn boring, so we want to try to avoid that today as much as possible. And after all, the purpose of most of these systems is to manage a project in order for it to come to fruition with more flexibility, reliability, and be on budget, and ultimately to ensure goals are achieved. Except, it turns out that they don't really do it that well. 70% of projects fall short on one of those pursuits. And this has been the number for about the past 4 decades, even with the advent of newer approaches like Agile. So Carol, what gives?
Well, you know, the reason I think this is a significant question and wanted to build something around it is Agile is used not only in business now, but also in education and I suspect in not-for-profits. And it's one of the long line of programs that whereby each one adds a smidge of something that inches us in the work that we're doing forward, but it falls short in so many ways and eventually dies off as a program, only to have another one raise its head with a new name and a new proprietor. But it is always announced as though something like this never existed. The same thing happens when we try and do education improvement. I think this is symbolic of how we develop new practices generally and why they end up so toxic. So the premise I think we might be testing here that our person who's sending the question asked for is, are all process improvements built off of scientific management, even in the creation of public education? And maybe do they all have a machine world view? And each new one is just an amelioration, another term I love, an amelioration of the original disruption of Taylorism. The new additions add some new problems every time they try and improve the last version.
So you mean Taylorism, continuous production, Kaizen, Proudfoot, Six Sigma, Agile, Toyota Production System, TPS Kaizen 2, Malcolm Baldrige, Root Cause Analysis, Total Quality Management, TQM, Zero Defects, Lean, ISO, Some Thousand, Lead, like those?
Yes. Yes, like those. And in education, it would sound more like No Child Left Behind, Multiple Intelligence, Gifted Programs, Remedial Programs. There are literally over 100 that you and I could rattle off quickly that have been tried over just the last half century. I recommend that we just take on the whole subject of process improvement and why nothing new is really happening most of the time rather than just looking at Agile. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, in the past, I think you referred to it as the amelioration parade. So in other words, you know, well, we tried what seemed better, but it has its problems. So let's fix those problems. And whoops, that made some good inroads, but it caused these other problems. Oh, well, let's just keep using it anyways. I'm going to take a wild guess, actually, that this happens because the next program designer uses the same paradigm to find the better path that caused the problems from the last glorious new answer. Once again, not heeding Einstein's warning and giving us actually fundamentally nothing new.
Well, you certainly can see why I use the parade metaphor. Each new group marches in front of the review stand, offering to fix something problematic from the earlier version. So Kaizen came in to fix scientific management's foundation by humanizing it and by getting rid of some of the work that overtaxed humans' abilities. And Howard Gardner created multiple intelligence because it took not into account all of the arena, because the previous versions had not taken into account all of the reasons a child could have gifts. So each new version works on what was missed in the last one by usually tacking it on rather than stopping most of the existing problems. It is not with bad intention people do this. So I need to say that. But it is by starting from the wrong place. And it's why I say don't start with existence, that is, the problems we have, but start with essence.
So don't start with where you are, but where you want to go. Is that what you're saying?
Well, close, but the way I might state it is, what is the essence of great improvement, which because we're working on process improvement, when, and how do you know when we're there? Starting with the problem, i.e. the current situation that we're in, is insufficient because it lies in existence. So the question is, what are the criteria for great productivity, great achievement, and what are the effects that you expect if you were to have the essence of that be what you change toward?
That actually makes a lot of sense, but doesn't sound all that easy to figure out. Most of the time we look at doing slightly better than before by solving problems we know about because of the last attempt we made, right? So how do we break that mental habit of starting with what we know needs fixing? I definitely want to try that out on Agile and other similar programs, and maybe even if we get time, even education programs.
If you want to find the essence of productivity and achievement, then let's start with what we need to think about in systemic terms. Like, what are the core effects we should see if we had great productivity, great process improvement, and a great way to work? What would we see? Then we can look at what the core capabilities are that are necessary to achieve those effects repeatedly and at a higher level. And finally, and you're right, these are not instantly easy, but finally, we can then examine whether any current hot practice like Agile or multiple intelligences are designed to build those capabilities and realize those effects. We need to know what the dream is we are pursuing, and we need to stop just running away from the past. And we don't even want to just run toward the future. We really want to think about what are the right things to be happening systemically.
So my stepson decided he didn't do as well as he would have liked in one of his math classes last year. And he was nervous about calculus this coming year. So we started talking about all the bad habits that he, you know, wants to try to avoid in order to help him do better next year. But, you know, I'm thinking now on reflection, a better place to start actually is by asking him, why does math matter anyways? And from there, we could maybe start with another question, which is, what does it take to become the student that can achieve that end in math? And then I support him to work on that and build his own skills towards making that happen.
you know, part of me wants to laugh when I listen to that, but it's really dead on that we tend to start with how can we fix the stuff that's not working.
Okay, great. So where do we start?
Well, I put together three core effects that I thought we might consider as kind of the essence of process improvement or productivity improvement. And then we can add to that some specific nodal capabilities needed for each of them. So the first one is, in a business setting, I would say the thing that we're essentially trying to create and we should be able to measure any process improvement against would be financial effectiveness. I mean, we are in business after all. Even if you're a small sole proprietor, you got to pay the bills. So you got to have financial effectiveness. And you'd be asking, does this process improvement give us the ability to direct and to manage our earnings, our margins, our cash flow? And can everyone see how every action they are taking as they work in their productivity places is going to affect those outcomes?
Right. So this is the definition we use of regenerative financial effectiveness, where all stakeholders experience evolving wealth and well-being. In education, it's really about providing real, unique value to the student, and therefore being able to support them putting something of unique value into the world. We need to do a whole show on that way of understanding value, I think.
Yeah, we need to do a whole show on a whole lot of things. But in the meantime, people could go, if they're interested in this subject, and look at the Regenerative Business Development community in the show notes, where we do a lot of work trying to help people make those connections. And multiple companies come together there to learn about this outcome. And there's a website for it, Carol Sanford Institute, where you can find the offerings. But let's go ahead on looking at what is it we're looking for in the outcomes to see if the process improvement's producing that. The second one I call internalized global imperatives. Are we living and working in a way daily that is how Earth and society become increasingly vital and viable? Internalization is about understanding something in a way we can't forget it. We can't unknow it because it is us every time.
So is what you're saying that what it really takes to work on global imperatives is something that fundamentally drives us? For example, me telling myself, self, I will not let myself act out of ignorance or laziness. I don't think of this as being about productivity so much, but why we even drive for efficiency in the first place, right? Like what animates us there? So after all, it's easy to forget about systems effects. So I think you're right, Carol. This should definitely be in there.
Yeah, and it's one we do leave out a lot. We know we're violating everything we believe in when we start to give excuses of why it's okay to skip it this time or to think about, well, I personally had to think about this and needed to take care of myself, or we just kind of take a minimalist way out and ignore things. How little can I do and feel okay about myself? That means something is not internalized as a global imperative. But let's look at this third criteria for assessing these process improvement programs. Human development. We should design human systems that foster evolution of core human capabilities. All productivity and process improvement programs need to grow and contribute in all kinds of institutions to this new capability. And I write a lot about this in the regenerative business and how to do that measurement. When they come into being in that way, they foster internal locus of control instead of its opposite. Most of them make people feel like the control is outside of them and don't stand for it being inside of them. They don't look at external considering in other folks and how I need to think about them. They think about how this is going to affect me. And people don't think about what agency they're going to put in based on what they think is the right thing to do in a larger way, but more what they feel like they're being compelled to do. So this ability to develop these three core characteristics should be embedded in a process improvement program. I'd be asking questions about that.
So those three desired effects seem pretty huge, Carol. But productivity programs are often offered to, you know, quote unquote, move efficiency with more participation. So can we take it down another level, like something we can check out with more direct connections?
Yeah, of course. So the primary driver of financial effectiveness, our first criteria, is innovation. In every aspect of the business, including everything from a new industry offering to daily tasks like scheduling, can we be innovative about that? innovation in operational processes produce cash flow, innovation in offerings that we build in products make margins better able to be reasonable rather than feel like they're too tiny, and innovation in value-adding return gives us more enduring earnings. And so we should be able to make that correlation I just made, and we can tell if a productivity program is fostering innovation, then it's going to build financial effectiveness. Building capability to have everyone innovating, resulting in innovative outcomes, tells us that we're going to have financial effectiveness. I think that's pretty grounded. And so the question I would ask is, do the innovation programs you know about do that? Does Agile, for example, do that?
Yeah, I guess most of what Agile ensures is that we break everything down and with continuous improvement, get work as much as we can on automatic to ultimately avoid variances in workability. That's the real driver of how Agile is structured. I guess you can come up with ideas on how to move the system more efficiently towards customer specified standards, but yeah, that's kind of how it's all held together. So I guess the opposite approach is to get people awake and reflective about how they work. So yes, we should ask if Agile or any other process improvement program like Six Sigma is designed to put innovation at the helm of the production process. I got it. Some things to figure out, but it definitely makes sense. So we can check every principle and practice, not for improvement, but for innovation. So what's capability number two driver for global imperatives, internalization?
Well, you probably could feel it when I was talking about earlier. It's the ability to act from integrity. It's hard to be in the present moment with what we know and the implications of our actions on what we know, unless we have internalized the meaning and the implication of our actions. So if I choose to buy a product that I know I can't recycle the packaging of it, for example, or I decide to build something and I don't bother to find out what all the ingredients in it and the toxic fumes in it, that is a process of not taking responsibility for an internalized sense of the implications and meaning of my decisions. Do I ask, is it good for the planet and the society for all people on the planet? We easily trade off and put off into the future timing the effects we know or claim that we did not know, or we position ourselves as better than those other bad guys by comparison, and therefore we can feel superior. So we are not really the bad guys. We want to not be the bad ones. It is only this one time, we say, and we offer an excuse for it. So the real challenge is, do process improvements, that programs that are built, help us actually feel and take responsibility in an internalized way with integrity? And that should be integral to the program. So we have to ask, are our programs we're looking at here doing that?
So Carol, are you saying we have no integrity inherently as individual humans, and therefore we operate the same way in designing improvement systems? We do this all the time, I guess, as I think about it. Say one thing, but do something else unconsciously, and then rationalize it afterwards. Mostly we ignore this global effect criteria unless it's in a program for that specific intent, like sustainability, which fails to take into account the process improvement does, for example. It's inherently a fragmentary approach, once again, like process improvement. But with global imperatives, talking about it is generally an uphill battle in organizations, I found. But I still want to know, what is the core capability needed for human development?
So back to our third criteria. Well, we talked about that in the last two episodes and how to assess hiring in a way that you could help people development happen. Does the improvement program like Agile increase the overall intelligence of every person affected by their offering? Now, I don't mean their skills or their ability to have the knowledge they need on hand. I mean actual intelligence. And the same is true here for human development effects. Do people get smarter every time they work, while they produce something? Do they come away and say, wow, I'm learning to figure out things. I am able to invent and conceive of things in a way I didn't before. Do they stop and reflect and integrate new learning and discoveries as they go? Very few programs do that. So we know most of our productivity process improvement programs are going to fail this test. They may gain a new skill. They may gain some new knowledge. But are they better thinkers? Are they able to manage their state of being? That's very different.
But Carol, there's got to be another way if every process improvement has these massive shortfalls. I want to make sure we come back to how to work on these process improvements in a way that advances these three aspects: financial effectiveness, global imperative internalization, and human development evolution. But I know we have to go through the sermon process first, so everyone can see how to do this for themselves.
Yeah, I thought about that in advance of today, and I think there's a bit of a shortcut that we can use with a few things that people could even use to evolve their own current systems. But you can't start with the process improvement program, but you've got to actually redefine how you're seeing things. And I call that using living systems principles. And it's not something you go change overnight. You begin to educate people about this over time. What we're really working on here is how we get these three effects to happen, not just intermittently and by accident and usually less well than desired, but how we can overcome this thing I call the amelioration parade and what we're seeing. And that's what I really want to be able to do.
So I know that scientific manufacturing or Taylorism broke up all work into small pieces with each person having a dedicated job and specified how each task should happen, how fast, and then evaluated each person against these standards. They added overseers and supervisors for good measure to see where improvement was needed. Do I have that about right?
Yeah. So what we're watching for here is to begin to look at the work system as a whole. Yes.
Okay. So then in a flow of work that has specialists who are doing narrowly specified jobs with supervisors is still all there, but Kaizen took out some of the cruelty of Taylorism, where work was very hard on humans' health and well-being, and even times demeaning and actually injuring people. But what they didn't do is they kept the flow of work as pieces or tasks with supervisors and specialists. So it turns out Kaizen was arising around the same time as the governing oversight for health and safety workers, which is now called OSHA. So that ended up pushing Kaizen forward a bit around the idea of human life is worth taking care of.
Right. So you're helping us see the ameliorations. We had Taylorism. Kaizen came in and took about a piece of it. Were there any really big changes from Kaizen? Because that's the question we're asking.
Well, I guess rather than being standardized and having their job protocols defined, there was this idea of improvement as differentiated from innovation, which I think was pretty radical at the time. The improvement was spoken to as being continuous. And I think you'll hear this language used a lot around Kaizen. But also, teamwork was introduced with Kaizen, and the idea of individual personal agency or discipline was introduced, itself being actually a very Japanese idea. There were attempts to improve overall morale and behavioral interventions, which had emerged as a result of behaviorism being introduced and some limited understanding of human motivation. It also moved into the realm of education, kind of taking it from that realm and applying it into schools. But those are still mostly organized on the Taylorist factory model. Schools in this model are seen as student factories that can be improved, but mostly for efficiency. So this idea of man and children as machines seems to die really hard.
Yeah, so that's a really important one to be ameliorating. It's one of the worst effects of Taylorism and the process improvement. And Kaizen was working on getting rid of that, but it still left the fragmentation of work, as you pointed out, and specializations that made everything kind of generic across industries and subjects. So we know right now that genericism undermines financial effectiveness, and we've still got supervisors, which mean people aren't yet thinking for themselves. But Kaizen and other process improvement did take people into account and their lives into account, which Taylorism did not. Plus, it added getting them involved with suggestion boxes and decisions that were close to them, you know, not too far out. That became really important. I'm sorry, I find all that a little bit demeaning, so I have to say it with a tongue-in-cheek.
No, that's fair. I mean, these are good additions, right? But then the parade continues since so much was still missing, as you say. So in then comes total quality management, which was introduced by W. Edwards Deming and Walter Schuert. It changed the focus a bit beyond just production to paying attention to the quality of the outputs to meet the rising expectations of customers. So more computer tools actually made it possible to know how customers felt. Surveys told manufacturers what they thought they wanted, and computer data was actually now being collected and let efficiency improvements become trackable.
Yeah, and when you look back at this, you almost laugh, right? At these felt like such big things. So if we look at it with total quality management, we can ask, you know, what stayed the same and what really changed? Because our hypothesis is not much changed.
Yeah, it's really not much different than what Kaizen did, except a bit of a step up in human involvement. The Toyota version gave line workers independent authority to shut down a line, which has rarely been adopted in the rest of the production improvement processes. But I should point out that in schools, this was also introduced for teachers, but it did not change anything for students on any large scale.
Yeah, so again, the fragmentation. So there's one other one we don't have time to look a lot at, but did Six Sigma add anything new?
Six Sigma ended up building a gradation of expertise into the consulting team and those people left to lead it. So they were defined as experts, which we just talked about the trappings of that in our last episode. It also added a new level of hierarchy to the mix. But really here, Carol, I want to get to Agile because I think it was trying to do something additional, although not yet meeting RFX criteria you started with.
Well, what is thought with Agile that you think is beyond the previous process improvements?
Yeah, so Agile brought in more of the impact on humans in a work setting, like how they're affected by schedules, for example. They explicitly move supervisors to becoming trainers and coaches to help get decisions made and jobs done. They explicitly speak to the paradigm of command and control and the need for it to be replaced. They broke down some of the standardization processes left over from Taylorism. Again, many of these other things were left untouched that were actually fundamental to what was being pulled forward, making innovation and the building of intelligence and attention to integrity really difficult. So, in other words, Agile Scrum added a few more ameliorations to Kaizen and Taylorism.
Well, let's take the next step, just so, because I know you get depressed when we get to this stage often. And let's look at what has always been missing, whether it's in business or education, from all of these. And the connection to financial effectiveness, to global imperatives, and to development of the core human capacities that make life rich and meaningful is missing from all of them for the most part. But mostly what's missing is putting in place what it takes to make them happen. So to be effective at any of these three aspects, we have to have a capability to see the work as nested. We have mentioned that briefly in an earlier episode. I'll find that listed in the show notes. But unless you listen to a business second opinion regularly, it's unlikely that that's a very familiar idea. It means the design of performance programs should be able to be explained via three lines of work that have a relatedness to them. It's drawn from how living systems work. On a human level, for example, we are nested in a place like a city or a watershed, which is nested on a continent or a particular planet named Earth. And there is nothing that happens with each of those without them affecting the other. Some have more power to help or hurt, but all affect one another. There's something you're familiar with, Zach, from your own experience as a financial manager, an organizational development practitioner, now a business owner. You can see these nested things all the time. An owner is nested in a business, which is nested in a market and an industry, and that is nested in a national governing process. And that happens whether we like it or not. So let's take an example to show these three lines of work and how they are nested so that we can actually check them out and say, does scientific Taylorism do this? Does Kaizen? Does Agile? You got an example?
Yeah, so I'm going to pick out an example that I think everyone will know. So if you think of a farm, right? If I think of a farm, I have to grow and keep healthy the soil and the farm and the produce and myself as the farmer and consider those who benefit from our output like distributors and markets. But I also have to take care of the industry and its integrity and the social system where we live, right? So the farmer is actually the first line. They have to get better at farming. They have to innovate in their place and time. Okay, so then the suppliers and the distributors in the larger market are the second line that I talked about. I, as the farmer, need to work with them to innovate for their benefit, as well as for the benefit of all the restaurants and the people who eat there. And then if you were to go out another level, the third line is the entire food web and the place where we are farming and making these offerings.
Yeah, that's a pretty straightforward example. But how often is all of that in the mind of a farmer or a distributor or a supplier? Not often. And in fact, I've been told very frequently when I'm working with businesses that they most of the time don't even have the customer or consumer in their mind because they've got the product and what they're making. The place where they are doing all this is often seen as generic, with which if we're lucky, they have some standardized sustainability practices, which often that doesn't even exist. Because the watershed is not human, we don't see it as alive. We don't see it as being affected by what we do. And we see suppliers in that second line of work as a cost center that we have to manage. And the industry, if we think about it at all, we don't see it as part of our responsibility. So most farmers don't have a direct connection with their effect on the health and the regeneration of soil. Now, I'm not talking about sustainability organic farmers, but the average farmer, the 95% of farming, doesn't think about potent water, the role of the biota in the system, and the healthy guts having healthy microbiome. So there's only one level that matters usually. It's the farmer working with maybe a few sustainability practices, but not seeing this dynamic nested system at work from some of their described best practices. But from a living systems view, the world is made up of nested wholes, and it's complex and it's interdependent.
So now let's look back at Taylorism, Kaizen, and Agile. If I look at them, they're all working on only one line of work, the first line, right? Inside the organization. So if we were to think about the nest, right? The nest of the factory or school, as we talked about in a more regenerative view, you're talking about the individual workers working on the second line teams delivering to third line markets. The work design in all of these previous examples is about working on improving the second line only. This is really about how people in the creation and production processes can improve how they go about doing their own working, right? It's very inward facing. The issue is actually neither individual nor teams in any of these model programs is actually directly connected to the market. All their connection comes through data collected by others, translated to them, and then they can figure out how to meet those goals. But it's all given to them second and third hand. In Taylorism, no one even actually bothered to tell them what the customer or customers or consumers wanted. They were just told what to do. But in Agile, the hierarchy is kinder, gentler in terms of transmission and a transmission system, which gives more freedom and allows people to decide how to respond effectively and efficiently. And if you compare the previous iterations over the generations, this all seems pretty good, right? We seem to be like making some good improvements. But if we compare it to what we know is possible, it seems actually like a slow crawl with what would actually get us to the jumps possible with a work design with three lines of work. With a design that produces 10x evolution in earnings margins and cash flow over short periods of time. On top of all this, the Agile system has no global imperatives embedded in it because they're often not corporate-wide initiatives. Like within sustainability initiatives, these systems live in separate departments from the Agile teams, which are fragmented across the organization.
Yeah, and we haven't even talked about the fact that first line of work is missing, you know, the work on that development of intelligence. But I think that's probably enough for this episode of Business Second Opinion. I think we need to go do another show on this and really look more deeply about the shortfall of Agile, especially as we reference it to the development of living systems, their way of working, rather than just comparing it, which most people do when they tell stories about it, compared to how much better it is than Taylorism and Six Sigma, total quality management, and of course, command and control. That's why, because you keep doing that backward look, that it's so slow and incomplete.
So one of the things I want to do with this show is actually summarize where we've gone from here and then kind of tee up what we'll do for the next show to give people kind of a synopsis of where we've been. So the same paradigm that created Taylorism is still at work even in the most recent process improvement programs. This is the idea that humans are machines but can be incentivized to gain improvement. But you have laws introduced requiring employers to keep workers safe. Eventually, the incremental improvements of Agile have added their hearts and motivation being engaged, right? We make these incremental ameliorations and improvements, but in the end, it's still this amelioration parade.
So we've before described that as a particular paradigm consciousness, like the machine paradigm. And if it's the core practice, then you're lucky if you get improvement and never get to innovation. So, yep, that's the first summary from the first point of today, I think.
Okay. So second, you cannot get real meaningful criteria without testing with higher order criteria like financial effectiveness. I think we can all agree that everyone needs to keep their household together, and financial effectiveness is core to doing absolutely just that. Global imperatives are key because Mother Earth and democracy needs this, and so do we to have any place to live and engage. And then are we really developing humans according to their full capacity? Or are we just aiming at making people happier for productivity for the business with a focus on past plans? We can't actually measure how good something is if you're only comparing it to the bad you're moving away from and the few problems you may have solved in that process.
Yeah, I want to say that again. You cannot get to the best place by justifying a better place than what the worst one was. It better easily becomes a distraction and the enemy of best.
And third, if we don't design process improvement with three lines of work involved, and instead just think about the workers, we cannot pursue, much less achieve, our three criteria. We have to connect workers and everyone in the business to the external world directly and not have intermediated information digested and passed on. It does not provide the will, creativity, or even sufficient understanding.
Yeah, and the summary here for me is will is really activated by beneficial effects that we see are possible from our labor, not just freedom to work in teams with one another and feel autonomous and flexible, but to see what difference I make. These work designs don't have that. We have to feel the realization of the effect in other people's lives and maybe even the life of other living entities.
And next time we will talk about the first line, the way of engaging workers, teachers, students themselves to achieve our three criteria, particularly in the development of human capacity.
Maybe plus a couple of shortfalls of all the process improvement programs, including Agile, because I'm not sure I've gotten quite all of that out of my system. So we'll probably come back to a little of that.
And also don't forget to check out our show notes for the Harvard Business Review articles we use to offer a bit of insight into the history of process improvement for the past 200 years. And the list of other shortfalls we will cover in the next show are also in the show notes. And thanks to Gary Hendrickson of Five Maples Development Communications in Vermont for suggesting our topic. We are sending you a Get a Second Opinion mug that holds 20 ounces of your favorite beverage. If you want one of our Get a Second Opinion mugs, send us your ideas. You can email us at carol@businesssecondopinion.com or find us on Twitter at biz_second_opinion, all lowercase. Also, your ratings and reviews on any platform help people find us and spread the word. So don't forget to sign up to our newsletter. And thanks as always to Numi Tea. They actually sponsor our show notes and are our local champion for the upcoming Regenerative Business Summit, November 19th. So be sure to check out the website. You can learn how your essence can become a powerful decision-making guide to grow your business. Carol, what do you think about Numi?
Well, I think Numi are great, and I'm so excited that they're going to be one of the sponsors and hold one of the local fusion, local virtual opportunities in Oakland. So if you're near there, you should let us know, because there will be a couple of locations besides just the Oakland opportunity. Numi's great. Thank you, Numi.
This has been Business Second Opinion. Thank you.